Hello and welcome to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. I am Maria Demerges, the Deputy Director at Bruegel, and today we're here for an installment of the Director's Cut series focusing on the ECB. My guest today is our own research fellow here from Bruegel, Gregory Claes. And welcome, Gregory, and thank you for joining us.
Hello, Maria. Thank you.
And Gregory, we are talking today about a recent blog that you have actually published on the way that the ECB is forming its decisions. And you have looked back from day one of the decision-making process of the ECB, and you have documented the way that they have actually taken decisions at the various points in time. Can you first walk us through the main content and motivation behind this blog?
So yeah, we thought we looked at all the decisions. There have been many decisions taken since 1998, actually. Yeah. And at the beginning, it was very important for the original Governing Council members to reach consensus or unanimity, because they thought it was really important to speak with one voice. But we have seen, of course, that during the crisis, taking decision by majority became more important and more useful, and allowed them to be more timely. And therefore, we wanted to take a deeper look into that and really document all of those 330 decisions.
And what you've done is you went back and looked at the way that these decisions were made, whether it was by consensus or by unanimity or by majority voting. Do I understand correctly?
Exactly. Okay. We use those three categories to separate them. Sometimes, of course, it was more difficult because some of the decisions were taken together. So on some occasions, during some meetings, there were several decisions taken. So sometimes it's a bit difficult to disentangle them. But journalists actually ask a lot of questions about this during the press conferences. And it helped us. We use this kind of sources to see which decision was taken and how they did that.
So for the benefit of our audience, explain a little bit to us how this was done. It's not documented whether these decisions were taken by unanimity or by consensus or by majority voting. What you've done is you looked at press conferences and deduce from the wording, basically the questions that the journalists have posed, whether this decision was done one way or the other. Am I correct?
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Indeed. Contrarily, for instance, to the Federal Reserve of the US or the Bank of England, the ECB does not publish the votes or really detailed minutes of its meeting. Therefore, it's not possible for us to use that. And what we had to do is to look at other sources. So as you were saying, most of the decisions, we found it in the transcript of the press conferences. So there is an introductory statement by the president, and then there are question and answer from the journalist. And we used a lot of that. But there are other sources also that we used, like the transcript of the monetary dialogue. So this is when the president of the ECB meets with members of the European Parliament. So that's another source. We also use, for instance, the letters that the president sent to some of the members of the parliament. Sometimes they ask questions by written in written form. So we try to use all those different sources since 1988 in order to try to find. But it's a very difficult work, and more difficult than it is for people looking at Bank of England or Fed decisions.
Indeed, because they're not documented. So let's go then to some of the results that you found in this very interesting, effectively, database that you created from scratch. And in the blog itself, when you plot the data, if I may say, you separate the data basically in the three periods under the different governors. So you have the initial period by President Dijsselbloem, then you have the second period, which is President Trichet, and the latest period, one that is about come to an end, by President Draghi. And walk us a little bit through the results of this, of the three separate, if I may call it, president's period, and then we can go back and see whether we can understand what we make of it.
But I think the most important result from this database is that it confirms our hypothesis that decision making in the Governing Council has really evolved during those three presidencies. At the beginning, if you look at Duesenberg's era, basically, first, every decision was taken by consensus, or sometimes Duesenberg didn't even want to tell how the decision were taken. But so there is never any unanimity or majority. It's always by consensus.
I see.
Then, so basically no majority decision under his presidency.
Yeah.
Then there was Trichet's presidency, where he also mentioned that collegial decision making was an important priority for his presidency. He even mentioned that to the European Parliament when he was appointed as president, and he made sure that it was the case during his presidency. So his presidency is also characterized by a lot of unanimity decision or consensus decision.
Can you walk us through the difference between unanimity and consensus, if you can?
Yeah, of course. It's a bit complicated. Unanimity is quite easy. It's everybody voted for the same thing. Majority is also easy. Half of the people at least voted for the proposal. Consensus is a more blurry concept, I have to say, and therefore it had to be defined also by the president himself. Okay. So, for instance, so we found when we documented and we looked at all those sources, we found some definition in there, and Duesenberg defined it basically as the fact that a decision was taken without a vote having to take place. So there might have be some people were against it originally, but then they managed to reach a consensus by the end of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have to take a vote because he didn't want a vote to be taken, basically. And Draghi also defined it later, and he said a bit the same. He said that no one objected. So the way we understand that is that there was no clear dissenter to the decision. Mm-hmm. While in a majority decision, even if there was only one dissenter, that person would really not want to follow the majority to reach a consensus. They would prefer to say, no, I'm against it, and I want a vote to take place so that we note in the minutes, even though they are not really called minutes at the ECB, we note that it was not a unanimity or consensus.
You were saying that in the Duesenberg's era, there were almost always, you said, a consensus. In the Trichet era, there was also unanimity or consensus, and then after that?
No, in the Trichet era, Trichet was much transparent than Duesenberg. Because he mentioned the difference between unanimity, majority, and consensus. And actually, he's the first one who has really separated this into three categories. And he was really keen in mentioning that in the press conference. So sometimes he was even telling himself during the introductory statement that which kind of decision was taken. And then he was eager to reply to journalists when they were asking questions about that. So that's actually the more transparent era. Where you really see the difference between unanimity and consensus and majority. So he used in big majority, he used unanimity or consensus in decision making. But after the crisis, actually, he had to resort to some majority voting. Actually, to be precise, majority voting had to be used once only from 1998 to the crisis. It was used once in 2006, and it was only used because it was during the tightening period. Some member wanted more tightening. So this is the only occasion before the crisis where majority voting was used. Oh, okay. And then it was used in 2010 when the crisis started, basically to put in place some policies, basically to do the... So in May 2010, when they started the securities market program, so when they started buying bonds from countries that were that had problem financing themselves in the market, then at that point he had to resort to majority voting. That was the first time during the crisis that Trichet had to use majority voting under his presidency.
Yeah. And then after that, in the Draghi era.
Then in the Draghi era, we had much more majority voting. So only three, I said, during Trichet, zero during Duesenberg, and then when the Draghi era came, we had like 18 majority decisions that were taken. And actually, it represents actually a lot of decisions because, for instance, on rate changes, it represents more than 50% of the rate changes that took place during Draghi. So he had to use it a lot. And he used it for rates, but he also used it a lot for asset purchases, of course.
So, I mean, I think it's important to try and understand what we make of it, right? effectively the majority voting, if it gives us one message, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there is basically more disagreement. I think when that's almost by definition, right? In unanimity and consensus, there's just more agreement, easier to come to decisions. In majority, the disagreement. Now, is that a reflection of president styles? Because obviously that's kind of the first thing that we see from your graphs. Or is it more an issue of basically difficult times? I mean, if you see the era in which Draghi had to operate and some of Trisha's operation, there were the crisis years, so years where not of much of what is going on actually we understand, and therefore we are sort of making it up as we go along. And I'm sure the ECB, up to a point, was doing that. Some very drastic measures that were taken at the time, both in terms of the interest rate reductions, but also in terms of generating new instruments. So is this really a reflection of a style, or is it much more a reflection of uncertainty, or of both? What's your take?
It might be a difference in style also, because I think now it's less important for the ECB to speak with one voice. During Luxembourg's era, or maybe at the beginning of Trichet's era, the ECB was a very new institution, and therefore it was important for the ECB to speak with one voice and to be credible and not to have dissenting members, etc., that would undermine the decisions. Now, maybe it also might be less important for the ECB that now is now 20 years old. So that's my first thing, but I also agree with you that it's difficult to disentangle the main driver between this increasing trend in the use of majority decision. Because, yeah, it could be because of Draghi, it could be because it's less necessary, but as you said, it might also be because we have been using a more and more unconventional policy. And so some members of the governing council might not be comfortable with those. Before it was easy, it was just increasing rate or cutting rate. This was pretty much conventional. Now we are talking about asset purchases, targeting long-term refinancing operation, negative rates, something that the member of the governing council were not really used to do before. So some of them might have been uncomfortable to do that.
Yeah, and I suppose the crux of the matter is, what do the markets think of this? Have the markets distinguished, have the markets reacted to this change of style from real consensus building and unanimity down to sort of a progressively less and so consensus and down to majority, which is the most democratic, if you like, way of doing it? Do you think that there is, have the markets noticed this, and is there a visible reaction in some of the market numbers?
It doesn't seem so. I haven't looked to the impact of, for instance, majority decision on yields or something like this, yeah, or on the Ionia. We could do these kind of things, actually. But I haven't done that. But actually, I wouldn't say that Draghi's time, which was more characterized by majority decision, was a problem for market. Even though some of the decisions were not taken at unanimity, like, for instance, the most important ones, or whatever it takes, or the OMT, we know it was not taken unanimously. We know there was a dissenter, and they had to take a vote, and there was a majority, even though the majority was everyone but one. But the market still accepted that and considers that as one of the most important tools of the ECB, and
it worked
well.
Right. So I think since we are waiting for a new president to be nominated and come to power, we will focusing on your results, we would expect that this majority voting will continue, and that might actually help in the decision making, mm-hmm, simply because it is an easier method of doing that. Now, you have also another interesting result in your blog, and that has to do with the difference between on the interest rate going up or on the interest rate coming down. Could you talk us through the main result that you found there?
Yeah, something that we found is that if you distinguish tightening from easing decision, so it's not only rate cuts, it can also be asset purchase or all other measures. So if you distinguish them by tightening and easing, actually, for easing, they had to use a lot of majority decision. While for tightening, it was almost always either unanimous or consensus. Only in two cases of tightening, the president had to use majority voting. But actually, when you look at the detail, those two majority decision were actually because dissenters wanted more tightening. So it seems that, like, the, let's say, the dovish members of the governing council, they are more ready to join the majority or to reach a consensus or unanimity if necessary. While some, let's say, more hawkish members of the ECB, they might be more ready to dissent to the decision to show their voice if they really disagree with what the ECB is, or the governing council is implementing.
So put it in different words, then it seems like the ECB can reach much more agreement when they are tightened than when they are easing.
Yeah.
That's actually an interesting result. I wonder what lies behind it. Is this a sort of a characteristic of the ECB? We have to remember that the majority of easing that has happened by big steps sometimes, that was during the time of crisis. And again, comes back to this idea that we are actually in crisis mode now, and we have to ease because we are preserving the financial system, and there is a lot of uncertainty. So uncertainty is always captured by dissent, by sort of, you know, variation in opinions. That's by definition almost. So I wonder whether your numbers actually tell us that it is an ECB evolving in that direction of preferences, or it is actually more of a sort of an uncertainty issue and you're operating under crisis.
I agree that most of the majority decision actually were about unconventional monetary policy. So it's true that this is decision for which there is, of course, a lot more uncertainty, as you say.
And less knowledge.
Yeah, and less knowledge. It's more difficult to decide about them, to know what are going to be the side effects. So of course it's more bound to disagree.
Okay, so we're not. This is not the last word that we hear on sort of, you know, whether the ECB has become more hawkish or more dovish on this issue. So tell us what's next on this line of research when it comes to the ECB voting style. Is there something that you're going to take this forward with? What are you planning to do next?
No, I don't know. I'm sure we can do a lot with this database because it's a very comprehensive database and it's the first time that someone does it. So I'm sure we could try some to look at some hypotheses using it. Because that's an interesting.
There is this line of research called the ECB Speak, which is about the way that we understand communication, and as actually we move forward, the role of communication in trying to inform the markets and beyond the markets about the economy, what the ECB is going to do, is actually going to play a greater role. And we are hoping, as that the new ECB president, in some of the work we've actually done together, the role of communication will take a more prominent role. And I think the ECB has really taken many steps in terms of trying to increase the transparency, which in the context of high uncertainty still, they've done a number of steps to increase the transparency and therefore the accountability of the institution. So this is a very interesting line of research. I really hope that we will be able to continue this. And that brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sound of Economics channel, and thank you to my guest Gregory for coming. If you're interested in more of Bruegel's work, we have an array of blog posts and publications available at our website www.bruegel.org. I hope you'll join us again. Until next time, goodbye.